Thanks, Clinton. So he mentioned the seasons in his prayer. Here's your trivia question kind of before we get started. Where is it in the Bible that we have the mention that the seasons will always be? The first place it comes up in the Bible.
Genesis 8 chapter.
I believe it is the 8th chapter. So it's immediately after the flood, right? So Noah gets off of the ark and he sacrifices to God. And the very last verse, either chapter 7 or chapter 8, I think Bob may be right, maybe chapter 8, God says, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, summer and winter, cold and heat, that he will never destroy the earth again with the flood. Not that he won't ever destroy the earth again, but not with the flood. You know, the church has gone through many seasons as well, but it has always remained and it will always remain until Christ comes again. Bob's been leading an interesting class the last few weeks in Revelation about what that end may potentially be like for us as Christians, what it may be like for those who are not Christians, and the differences of our eternal abode. Dwayne is obviously out this week, and so he's asked me to step in and probably do an introduction of my class that I'll be doing over the next 3 months. Dwayne will step back in next week, so we'll have a little bit of a break. So I wanted to introduce the class. We won't dig into everything, obviously, today, but I'll give you an overview, and I'll also give you kind of an outline of what we're going to study in the 3 months that I'm with you. And what I would ask as we start in April is that you look at some of the outline material and you study it the week before so we can have a more meaningful engagement and discussion at each class period. So the topic, you're wondering, and you may be kind of figuring it out up on the board, is a historical journey that spans about 1850, 1860 years from Christ establishing the church until the Restoration Movement here in America. So, you may like history, you may hate history, think it's just for books and dust and cobwebs and things like that, but I do not like reading at all. I don't read for pleasure, but I will read history. I do find history to be pretty intriguing to me. So I hope that I can bring some of these stories and some of these examples of the early church to life to you to make them have more meaning and impact. And you may have some things that you'd like to bring up as well. So we'll use today as an opportunity for you to bring up some questions that you have in your mind about the history of the church and when did that take place or what really happened or what does this mean? I'll give you an opportunity and we'll include some of those things and I'll do some study and research on them to see if I can make a meaningful presentation to you. Obviously, we can get so in depth and so detailed that you want to poke your eyes out and get bored talking about the same little time span over and over and over. That's not my objective. My objective is to provide an overview of the most important things in the church's history to keep your interest, to keep your attention, and not get too bogged down on these things. So I will try to keep the class moving along as I see fit. Now, I've included some things that I find interesting to me, and I've excluded some things that I thought were a little bit boring or mundane. They all have their place. But like I said, you might have some things that are interesting to you that you want to bring forward. I've divided into 9 different time periods, and they're listed here above. So the first thing that we're going to do today is put these in order. So each one of these will be a class to 2 classes that we go over, one for a week or a week. It may take 2 weeks. Which is going to be the first one that we discuss? Historically. Okay, Christ establishes. Yeah, got that one to the top. So we're going to put the apostolic age. And what do we mean whenever we say the term the apostolic age?
After Christ ascended, then the apostles.
All right, it's the apostles that are preaching, establishing the congregations with the help of Paul as an evangelist. What's after the apostolic age? The apostasy. All right. What is the apostasy? What does that term mean?
When the church fell away from the truth that the apostles delivered.
Right, the apostate church. We also hear that term heresy, which is preaching or teaching that was not in accordance with the apostles' doctrine and what Christ taught in the 12 or in the four Gospels. And then we have the persecution attached to that apostasy. And we're going to get a little bit into some of the persecution of the church in that first century and the second century as well. What is after the apostasy? It'd be easier if you could see them all. What do you think? Imperial church. What do you think I mean by the imperial church? Well, what does imperial mean? It's an empire. It's the Roman church that was established. We're going to spend a good deal of time talking about how exactly did the Roman church get its foundation and its beginnings? How did it grow? And then how did it fall? How did it decline? And then have a resurrection from there. What's after the imperial church?
Arcadius.
All right. The Dark Ages. So that term, Dark Ages, is a loose term that started in the 1300s just to describe a time of very weak education, enlightenment. There were the plagues that went through at that time. They said that about one-third of the population, a third to a half of the population of Europe was wiped out during the plague in the Dark Ages. It's also called the Middle Ages. There's the Early Middle Ages, the High Middle Ages, and the Late Middle Ages. If you put all three of those together, that's the same as the Dark Ages. What's next?
Reformation.
All right. Reformation. And what's happening in the Reformation? Okay, there's one individual that we'll talk about in Martin Luther. Where was Martin Luther from? German. He was German. We have some other reformers that we're going to talk about.
I was just going to say the hold of the church was broken somewhat after the Dark Ages.
Okay, so in the Dark Ages, the Roman Catholic Church had the Bible in its own language. That's where we hear that term, that it was chained to the pulpit. It was only for the clergy and not for the laity. And there was it was a very terrible time for the church. And the Reformation began to break that stronghold that was evident in the Catholic Church and reinforced by the Roman government because they were one and the same. So we're going to talk about the dichotomy between the Roman Empire and the Roman Catholic Church. So the Reformers started to break some of that. Martin Luther in Germany did that. Know of anybody else? Any other names? Gutenberg invented the printing press and we had the Bible produced.
John Calvin, I suppose.
John Calvin was a late reformer in that time. We have a man named John Wycliffe. He was a professor at Oxford, a doctor at Oxford, who led the main Reformation in England. And then we have a guy by the name of Ulrich Zwingli. I believe that's how you pronounce his name. And he was from Switzerland. And he led a lot of that same breaking away from the Catholic Church. What's the next thing that we've got? All right, the Pilgrims. So we know that Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. But later on, we find other people coming over to the United States because they did not like the church of the state, the Catholic Church, and wanted to come to America where there was new opportunities to practice religious freedom. So that is our next one. America's religious freedom, which leaves the last one as the Restoration Movement. So in the America's religious freedom, we're talking 1776, kind of in conjunction with our nation being started, to about 1800. We're going to talk about a couple different individuals. We're also going to talk about different churches that were started. The Episcopal Church was a big one. And then the Protestant Episcopal Church, which became the new Church of England in America. And then finally, we're going to talk about the Restoration Movement, and that's from about 1800 to about the Civil War in the 1860s. We're going to talk about people like Barton W. Stone, Thomas and Alexander Campbell, the Brush Run Church, Walter Scott, John Smith, Ben Franklin, not the Benjamin Franklin that you see on your $100 bills, and then a little bit of the Civil War. And that's, we're going to go all the way from right around Christ's time and just a little bit before Christ's time, all the way up to the mid-1800s. Any questions kind of on the organization of those? All right. What I've used kind of as a guide to help me put these things together and understand these is Robert Brumback's book, The History of the Church. And I know many of you probably have a copy of this. If you don't, I'd recommend it. It's I've certainly not made my way through it all, but I've been reading it pretty heavily in the beginning. It brings up a lot of good historical information. I've been reading out of Josephus to put some things together in that first century history. I've been reading a lot of things, but this is kind of the most concise system of organization. And from that, I jump to other things and pull a little bit more detailed information, more from a historical perspective. I do want to read part of the foreword and the introduction of this book. Obviously, it's written by a man as he tries to chronicle what was going on with the church from when it started with Christ and the apostles to we have it today. So it's not perfect. He does make that well known in the introduction as well. So he lived in, I believe it was Indiana in Illinois, a good part of his life, and was a member of the Church of Christ out there. So here's what he says. The purpose of this volume is to tell in a simple and concise way the history of the greatest institution that the world has ever known, the Church of our Lord. When first the writer prepared a general outline of the history of the church, it was for his own benefit. At the request of members of his home congregation, the information was presented for their consideration. The interest created by the lessons brought requests from other congregations that they be presented there. Since that time, they've been presented before congregations from coast to coast. Brethren in various congregations suggested that the material which was gathered over a period of years be put in a book and thus made available to the brotherhood. The work of proclaiming the gospel and conducting Bible studies required so much of his time that the writer lacked opportunity to prepare material for publication. At the instance of his fellow laborer, Brother John Fleener, the writer agreed to undertake the work after he returned from his tour of the Bible lands. As a student of church history for more than 40 years and a teacher of it for a third of that time, the author accepted the task cheerfully. He now admits that it has not been an easy task to search out the source of the materials that he's presented. Confronting the author was the problem of what should be included and what should be excluded from the work of this kind. The reader may frequently be disappointed in failing to find information for which he seeks, and may sometimes find information which he believes could be left out. So as far as possible, proper credit has been given to all authorities and sources, ancient and modern. Some of the material, however, has been gathered from many works over a period of years and then edited, and it has not been possible to give proper credit since the author does not recall its source. Indebtedness to many books and authors is acknowledged, all of which are included in this biographical note. This history is not designed to replace any other history of the church. The public has been well supplied with extensive works upon this subject, but in the study of them, the elementary student may become confused at the great amount of material presented and lose interest. Church history is not identical with world history, since a large part of the world has never been subject to the church. Neither is it the same as religious history. For many religions exist separate and apart from the church Christ established. I thought that was a very good point, and I'm glad that he included that. It is necessary, of course, to separate church history from secular history. This the author has endeavored to do. However, it has sometimes been necessary to relate incidents of secular history because of their relationship to the history of the church. As it is true that every American should have a knowledge of the history of America, so it is true that every Christian should have a working knowledge of the history of the church. Next to the Bible, every Christian should be interested in the history of the church. As the reader studies the pages, he'll be able to see the church for which our Lord died and will be able to distinguish it from those which have been established by men. Jesus prayed that all those who believe on him through the apostles' teaching might all be one. The apostle Paul condemned division among those who profess to be the people of God in 1 Corinthians 3, 1-3. The divisions that exist in the religious world are a result of following men instead of following Christ. May all who see the division and strife that exist among men be prompted to begin the study of God's Word and led by its truth to obey the gospel of Christ and to be added to the one body of Christ. I thought that was pretty good, but like I said, even though he was a member of the Church of Christ, he was just a man, just like I am, and our thoughts, our philosophies aren't always perfect, aren't always accurate, but I thought that was good, and I agreed with his introduction. Let's see. So I'm curious, as we look at the topics above, that is the outline that I've got for the class, but I want to make sure to include some things that you've got questions about as well in the history of the church. So if you want to name out a few things, call out a few historical things that have been in your mind wondering about, and I'll put it down over here and make sure that we can study that in our 3 months. I'll get you started. Here's the things that some of them I've included. I always had questions about the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and what biblical principles might be contained in it. And I was also curious about the signers of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. What did they believe? Where did they go to church? The 18th and the 19th century denominations and their leaders, the persecutions of the early Christians, the canonization of the Bible, early manuscripts of the New Testament, and some of the Roman emperors. Those are some of the things that interest me. You may think that those are dull and boring, but what interests you that you would like to go over? Bob?
I'd kind of like to...
Wait a minute. I'm going to put you down here.
French Revolution.
Okay. French Revolution. So the church spread and it went to France, and there was a huge Battle of Tours in France that led a lot of the establishment of the church over there. And it had the French Revolution had a lot to do with the Church of Rome in that area. That's a good one. What else?
Isn't there a group, the Waldensians? Am I saying that right?
Yeah. Huh?
It's Waldens something. That this is going to be no help to you. I'm very sorry. For some reason, I thought they were a group during the Reformation, maybe even before the Reformation, that tried to be more accurate than the folks in the Reformation.
Okay, so we're going to call this the Waldens. What?
W-A-L-D-E-N-S-E-S.
Okay. I don't know about them. I'm still, like I said, I haven't got too far down in history. I'm trying to do the first few classes right now. It's not possible for me to put all that into my brain at once.
What about the Crusades? Constantine.
Okay. Okay, I've got that one in the class already, so we'll cover the Crusades and Constantine.
I know a lot of the pilgrims were Puritans, but I know quite a bit about them from early American literature, but I don't know about like the other pilgrims, the non-Puritan pilgrims, because I know there were other people that came from America.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, the canonization. Okay, so it's interesting. We've already got a connection between Constantine and the canonization of the Bible. I'm going to bring that up in one of the classes. Constantine was one that was pro-Christian, and he authorized the publication of 50 manuscripts to be carried out by Eusebius. You may have heard his name. E-U-S-E-B-I-U-S, I think is how you spell it. Eusebius. He was one of those early church writers. And Constantine told him, I want you to oversee the production of 50 copies of the current scripture that they had at that time. The way I understand it, there are three copies of those original 50 still in existence, from what I understand. Now, I may find something out a little bit different as I read more, but I think that there are three remaining. And you've probably heard of these. The Codex Vaticanus, or the Codex Vatican, the Codex Sinaiticus, or Sinai, I'm not really sure how to pronounce it, but it was found around the Sinai, Mount Sinai. And then there was one more. I think it was in Alexandria. These are three of some of the most early New Testament manuscripts that we still have today. Some of them are almost 90% complete and don't have many leaves missing. Some of them have more than the others. They've been photographed and documented. One of them's on file right now at the British Museum of History. And they're documented very well. So that's one place where we go to look at some of the canonization of the Bible. And in that first, second century, what were they actually using as scripture? So, and then later on, we find the 1611 version, quite a bit down the road, of the King James version of the Bible. Okay. That was a good one.
Yeah, and then probably you'll mention something about the Dead Sea Scrolls and like how they fit in with the other scriptures.
Okay. I don't have that one listed.
It was like a later discovery, like. What?
Yeah, it's more Old Testament documents. Yeah, so I hadn't included that one. We may, if we have time, we may include that one. But I'm really trying to focus in on New Testament and the church things that pertain to that. Any others, real quick? All right. I'll include those, and if you think of others, just let me know. Give me a call, send me an email, catch me before or after church and say, hey, I've really had a question about this, and I'll try to include it in the class. So we're going to come right over here to for our introduction, Christ establishing the church. What year did that happen?
33 AD.
Okay. But I think to have a better perspective of what was going on when Christ was establishing the church, we need to know what was the cultural environment like, what was the political environment like, what was going on in the world at that time. In the period of time before Christ, a large part of the world was pagan. And what did they worship?
Idols.
The sun, the moon, the star, the Greek gods. They worshiped them as well. The Philistines, in that time period before Christ, they had all their idols, like they did in the Old Testament. They still were holding on to them. And then there was one other thing. The Greeks and the Romans, not only did they worship the sun, moon, and the stars, and Zeus, and Mercury, and those folks, who else did they worship? The emperor. So every emperor had a statue or a bust made of them. And in addition to all these other people, the Romans and the people that were their subjects were to worship that image of the Caesar or of the emperor at that time. Immoral practices were a part of their religious services. Very immoral practices were a part of their religious services. And God told the Jews, before Christ even came, you know, you're going to come out of Egypt, you're going to cross the Red Sea, go through the wilderness, you're going to go 40 years, you're going to come up to the east side of the Jordan River, up on Pisgah. Moses is going to look out and see the promised land that he can't go into. And then all those who were under that age went across. And what did God tell them to do when they went into the promised land?
Drive them out,
destroy them. I want you to inhabit this land, and I want you to be my special people, set apart. Your worship will be different. Your life will be different. But what happened?
It wasn't
much different. They started out pretty strong, and then before long, they began bringing in some of this idol worship. They began bringing in some of their cultural practices of the pagans that lived in that area. But you know what also happened? The pagans were influenced by the Jews. And so the pagans began to do some things that looked like what God wanted to be done. And so we have this period of confusion and amalgamation of the Jews' practices and God's wishes and desires coming into the pagan world as well. In 63 B.C., I'm going to leave that on there so I can write those down. So in 63, before the Common Era, we have a Roman ruler coming in to take over Jerusalem. Pompey. You've heard of the city of Pompey, P-O-M-P-E-I-I, which I think is in Greece area. Italy, okay. In Italy, that's where Vesuvius erupted and all the people were buried in all the ash and everything else like that. But this is Pompey, the Roman ruler. He entered Jerusalem and he established control over Palestine. And there was, at that time, civil war and unrest in Palestine between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. We know of them very well. So we're still before Christ's time. There was unrest between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Pompey comes in, as all Roman rulers were, and they were taking over everything and changing the culture, changing the civilization. I want to read a little bit from Josephus, a first century writer, about what happened in 63 BC when Pompey came into Jerusalem. There was a great battle there that fought, and this is what he says: of the Jews there fell 12,000, but of the Romans very few. Absalom, who was at once both uncle and father-in-law to Aristobulus, was taken captive, and no small enormities were committed about the temple itself, which in former ages had been inaccessible and seen by none. So he's going to talk about what did Pompey do when Jerusalem was destroyed. And they came in to the temple. For Pompey went into it, and not a few of those that were with him also, and saw all that which was unlawful for any other man to see, but for the high priest only. There were in the temple the golden table, the holy candlestick, and the pouring vessels, and a great quantity of spices. And besides these, there were among the treasures 2,000 talents of sacred money. Yet Pompey touched nothing of all this, on account of his regard to religion, and in this point also he acted in a manner that was worthy of his virtue. The next day he gave order to those that had the charge of the temple to cleanse it, and to bring what offerings the law required to God, and restore the high priesthood to Hyrcanus, both because he had been useful to him in other respects, and because he hindered the Jews in the country from giving Aristobulus any assistance in his war against him. He also cut off those who had been the authors of that war and bestowed proper rewards on Faustus and those who mounted the wall with such readiness. So Pompey came in when there was internal conflict and strife among the Jews in Palestine, and he imposed his will in his way, but he said, I'm going to leave the temple as is. I appreciate the religion that you guys have for Yahweh, and I'm going to let you continue in that. And this Hyrcanus was one of the Jewish men who had helped Pompey, basically said, you can kind of help keep the peace here. So, that was in 63 B.C. One of the next things that we have is Augustus Caesar. So Pompey was one of the last of the Roman leaders of the Republic. And he was not an emperor. If you study some Roman history, you find that there was the Republic, there was the Senate, and there were all the generals and the lieutenants that went out and fought and everything. And Rome was ruled in an unusual way with that Roman Senate. And Pompey was in that time period of the Roman history as a leader of the Republic. Marcus Caesar was after him. Cato the Younger was after him. And then we have Julius Caesar. who you may have read about from Shakespeare, Julius Caesar. And Julius Caesar was the last of the Roman Republic rulers. After him, we start the age of the Roman empires. And I know Rick, whenever he taught down here a year or two ago, however long it was, he listed some of those Roman rulers. And we're going to go over those briefly and talk about them. But Augustus Caesar was the first emperor of Rome. Bob.
Would you make a comment about the difference between a republic and a, like, the emperor?
Okay. So the way I understand it is that the republic was ruled by the Senate, basically. And the Senate, kind of think about our current Senate in our democracy. We have the House of Representatives and the senators. They were supposed to represent the people. And in that time, like I'm sure it kind of is in our time now, they kind of represent a lot of their own interests. So they were a ruling group who basically determined what would happen with Rome. And they did have a person at the top of the food chain who was the leader of the Republic, and that was Pompey. Then they had all these generals that went out. They went to Britain and overtook Britain. They went to Africa and took over a lot of Africa, to Carthage. They went through Turkey and all of those places and cleaned house.
So a true democracy is really, a democracy is ruled by the majority, right?
Correct.
So if we say that we're a democracy, that we're really a republic, because we have people that represent.
It may be a fine line in splitting hairs,
right,
but there was certainly a strong difference, the power and everything that the Senate had. But, you know, you look today, look at the power that some of our elected officials have, which can be kind of scary.
So was the emperor more of a monarchy?
Yes. In a lot of ways. So there were dynasties as well, of the same lineage. There wasn't so much here. There was the Caesars of that line. There was the Flavian dynasty. There was the there was the Flavian was the biggest one. There was the... I'm going to have to do some more studying. I don't want to speak out of turn. But yes, there were some family traits that were passed down. And then there were some that didn't have sons, and they had to basically adopt a son to take over the throne. That happened toward the end in John's age that we'll read about. So it was during this time, you know, we're looking at Augustus Caesar. He took over in 44 BC, and he ruled for like 20 or 30 years. It was quite a while. But it was during this time that God made the decision, I'm going to send my son to the earth to bring about salvation and to create my kingdom and create my church. Think about that timing, you know. Why then? Why then did God choose to bring Christ to this earth as opposed to 2014? You know, there's a lot of reasons I think that God had. We probably don't, I mean, we understand about this much of why God chose that time. But
well, the main reason is we're told in the Bible, when the fullness of time was come, the time was right. The time of the earth and all things happening was right for Christ to come.
We don't have to understand all the reasons, but it was the right time. It was the fullness of time. You know, some people are going to say that because of the Romans conquering the world and bringing a lot of civilizations together, it made it easy for Christianity to spread. And then the persecution that came along, as we're going to study about, it spread the Christians quickly, and the church began to grow.
The Romans were known for making roads.
Mm-hmm.
That made the spread of the gospel easier, I suspect.
We're about out of time. I'll put one or two more down. We come into 37 AD. I think it's, I'm going to make sure that's right. No, we're still in the BCs. So after I said, you remember Pompey came through and basically made it a Roman state, but let the Jews kind of do their own thing, and they would send governors down there. Well, in 37 BC, Herod the Great was the one that kind of let the Jews do their thing. And that's who we read about a little bit in the Bible. Herod the Great was first. Then we have Herod Antipas, who ruled Galilee in the north in 4 BC. So we're coming right upon Christ's time. Rome sends Pontius Pilate to be a governor down. That's in 6 AD. So Jesus was very young then. And then Caiaphas was appointed the high priest of Herod's temple in 18 AD. And then we have in 41... Herod Agrippa was made king of the Jews by Emperor Claudius at that time. Then Agrippa II. But it's this Herod Agrippa that we know of from the scriptures as well, and Herod Antipas. Next week, what I'd like for you... Well, I guess it's not next week. It's going to be in 2 weeks. I want to talk about the Jewish revolt. And we're talking about... 60, mid-60s, 65, all the way to 70 AD when Jerusalem was finally destroyed. So the Jews were able to kind of do their own thing, but the Romans had come in and were lording it over them as the governors and having these figureheads pop up like Pontius Pilate and Herod's and things like that. And the Jews got fed up with the occupation, the Roman occupation of Palestine, and there began to be tension. At one time, there was one of the Roman soldiers who came in while the Jews were having a feast of the Passover around the temple. One of the Roman soldiers went up there in the evening one night, and he pulls down his pants and he turns around. And one area that I read said that he relieved himself. I'm not quite for sure if that's exactly what happened. But he made a terrible gesture to the Jews at a very sacred time. And the Jews killed him. And they killed several other of the Romans that were around him at that time. The Romans fought back. That infuriated them. You don't do that to us. The Romans were over you. They went into the temple. They desecrated it. They took out all of the articles of gold and silver. And they desecrated the temple. And the Jews turned around and slaughtered about 6,000 Romans. The Romans drew back out of Jerusalem. And then that got the attention of Rome. Vitellus sent Vespasian down, a former general back in here who had been out in Britain fighting wars for Rome. So Vespasian comes down to Jerusalem and he brings 4 legions of Romans with him. Some come up from Egypt. His son Titus came up with his own legion, the legion from Germany, and one from, I think, Syria, all came and converged together in Joppa, or Jappata, and they went over to Jerusalem, and in 47 days, it took them to break through all 3 walls of Jerusalem and destroy the city. So we're going to talk, though, about a time whenever, remember I said that they withdrew from the city for a while? A lot of people think that that's the time that Jesus spoke about whenever you see the abomination of desolation coming, to get your things and flee as soon as possible from Matthew chapter 24. So we'll look at a little bit of that. The history and the detail that is recorded by Josephus primarily about the destruction of Jerusalem I found very interesting. So we'll talk about that next week. Josephus was a Jew. He was sent up to Joppa or Jappata to try to hold it against Vespasian. And he was one of the only survivors. So they brought him out and basically said, instead of killing you, we're going to make you a patron, and you are going to write the history for us. And he became a traitor, basically, to the Jews. So the Jews hate Josephus because he flipped sides and worked for the Romans and was their historian. But he has a lot of good recordings and writings. Okay, any questions so far? That was a lot of information. I'll try to print some of these things off as a guide for you in class that you can keep with you as we go through here, and we'll try not to get bogged down. But next week, we're going to talk about Christ establishing his church in 33 AD in Jerusalem, just a little bit more. And we'll move right on into probably the apostolic age, 33 AD to 120 AD. We'll take a break.